We are chatting art, transport, communications, history. That's CATCH. We call it a catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our geeky subjects as myself and the lovely guests. In today's edition, we're talking about the state of Britain's rail network. How bad has it got? Surely it can all be sorted out. And if not, how can we fix the railways? Today we are completely honoured to be joined by engineer and writer Gareth Dennis. Welcome to the Catchcast, Gareth.
Hello, what an absolute delight to be here. Thank you, Mark, for having me, and hello to all your listeners.
Gareth, before we start on those bigger questions, you've rapidly become one of the most prolific and respected podcasters in the railway industry. You're a broadcaster, a lecturer, engineer, author of How the Railways Will Fix the Future, which we will talk about. But can I sort of start off with a personal question? How did you first get interested in trains?
Oh, I mean, I would be lying if I said it wasn't early indoctrination. So, you know, some of my earliest birthday cakes did have Thomas the Tank Engine attached to them. but I suppose I was, you know, from a fairly young age, I was fascinated by trains, by railways as well. I found the mechanics of the railway system fascinating, by which I mean, as you know, as a toddler, I wouldn't have worded it that way. Of course, I'd have just been interested by the fact that you have these corridors of sort of infrastructure that look very different to roads dedicated to moving things around. And I grew up in the northeast of Scotland, although you can't tell from my accent, it's no longer quite as strong as it might once have been. But yeah, I used to travel down. My grandparents were in North Devon. I had other family in Wales. And we used to drive the 650 miles from Inverurie down to North Devon, down to Braunton. It was at a time when there was the last surge of motorway building. So we were seeing, you know, the M60 around Manchester. We were seeing the M1 up from Leeds to York. We were seeing the M74 being completed. All these massive motorway projects along the M6 toll. And I was fascinated by these. The engineering fascinated me, but I realized as I got older that it wasn't necessarily a very good idea for us to have been dedicating all of this acreage, all of this environmental destruction to more lanes for cars. And one of the things that really captured my imagination was the Forth Bridge, this incredible railway structure spanning the Firth of Forth, this pretty hostile broad estuary, and the railway just sort of almost like it pacing across it with this incredible structure that absolutely fascinated me. We don't build anything anymore. Why does it look like this? How do we build it? What was it for? I was just fascinating. So from there, the degree beckoned, let's put it that way.
Yeah, you went on to study civil engineering at university then.
I did, yeah. So civil engineering at Edinburgh. Actually, Edinburgh doesn't do much with railways. There's only one or two lecturers there who did railways, and one of them's moved on. Still keep in touch with my old supervisor. Shout out to Martin Crapper. So I did the degree, did my master's in something rail. So my master's thesis I did in railways, and that kind of helped open the door into me having my job interview and starting work with design consultancy Atkins.
And what sort of work did you do with Atkins then?
So I joined Atkins in 2013, and pretty rapidly I was working on electrification, actually. So I was doing less about railway track design, which was what my kind of job title was a track design engineer, but more about electrification, because it was the middle of the Midland Mainline electrification project as it was then, before it was cancelled and uncancelled and cancelled again. And we were trying to work out the most cost-effective way of putting wires up between Bedford and, well, Sheffield, actually. And so I ended up doing a huge amount of work, lots of site visits around that project, but also doing other things. So I worked on High Speed 2, worked on Crossrail, worked on East-West Rail. So lots of these major schemes that, you know, are continuing to drag on today, of course.
Some of that electrification does look a bit, this is a complete layperson's term because I don't know as much about electrification as you obviously do, but it looks a bit, how can I put this, a bit chunky and sort of slightly over-engineered. Yes. Particularly the Great Western one, it looks really huge.
Famously.
I just wonder whether we've over-engineered it a bit.
Yeah, so the thing is, when you engineer something, the requirements, the specification, and what is important steers what it looks like. So the actual physical materials, things like steel, don't cost much. That's not where the cost of constructing electrification is. The cost comes from how much it costs to fabricate that, but also, most critically, how long it takes to put it up. And the thing about the chunky stuff you see on Great Western is that chunky style means that you can have fewer bits, so your meccano set is more simple, if you like. It also means that you can throw it up much more quickly. So when you've got a very, very busy railway like the Great Western Main Line, the time it takes to put that stuff up is much more important than going for a very spindly, lightweight design like you see on the electrification from the 1960s on the West Coast Main Line, which is much more triangles, little truss structures and things. Whereas nowadays we're going for big beams, because they're very easy to install and very quick. That doesn't mean that the Great Western Electrification Project was perfect, far from it. But the the cost element of it has very little, well, nothing to do with the amount of steel, and more to do with the fact that the project was rushed, that piles were put in before the designs had been finished, and so they were put in, you know, too far from the track in some cases to dodge services we'd not paid attention to. Oh, it was a mess. It was a real mess. But the steelwork might look, yes, it is pretty substantial, but a lot often that's because it's cheaper to put in a large, quick structure than it is to put something in much more lightweight that often requires, you know, more masts and more piling and all these sorts of things.
Right, okay, thank you for indulging me on that, because I've always wondered about it as I've gone past it and thought, that just does look a little bit strange. Now, I wanted to ask you about, you feel like you're a person who's just brilliant to listen to and you're great at passing on skills. I believe you started helping students of railway design.
Yeah, so I actually started my lecturing story, if you like, and I started to do teaching at the now ex-high-speed rail college in Doncaster. It had two campuses, one in Birmingham, one in Doncaster, and I was teaching kind of once every couple of weeks. I would spend the whole day teaching apprentices about track design, about rail infrastructure more broadly, and I absolutely loved it. And from that point, I've been finding opportunities to lecture elsewhere as much as I can. So I lecture at the University of Birmingham occasionally, and now I'm a regular lecturer for the Permanent Way Institution, which... the permanent way is basically the track, the ballast, earthworks, drainage, all sorts of things, but the kind of the fixed infrastructure for railways. And that the Permanent Way Institution is the professional institution. They do a lot of teaching students, whether it's young people joining the industry or people who are wanting to do kind of continuing learning. I've lectured on a few things, but at the moment I mostly focus, interestingly enough, for an engineer, I'm focusing on sustainability. That's not just the green stuff. More about that, I'm sure.
Now, you worked at a company called Sistra, but that came to an end last year in quite an unusual way. I don't know if you feel comfortable about explaining what happened there when you were trying to speak out about problems at Euston.
Yes, I was delighted to join Sistra as probably one of, if not the youngest professional head of track engineering in the country. Certainly I was at the time. I don't know if anyone's been younger than me in the past on that one. But yeah, very young, but picked into that role and was enjoying it, doing a great job. And then I happened to very briefly, in a kind of a fairly relaxed and inconsequential interview about Euston Station, talking mostly about the long-term plans for it and the need for government to be bold, alluded to the fact that, you know, from an accessibility perspective in particular, Euston Station was not safe. The Office of Rail and Road, which is the railway regulator, had already talked about the fact that there are safety challenges at the station. This was picked up by the current rail minister, then chair of Network Rail, Lord Hendy. He didn't like that, and so he forced me out of my job. I won't go into much more detail than that, but it's a pretty sorry affair. Did not reflect well on the rail industry, because we always talk about there, you know, as having a safety-first culture, but you know that episode was very much a reputation-first, safety-second situation, which and we saw in the aftermath of me talking about Euston Station having challenges, we saw the now ex-Secretary of State for Transport, Louise Hague, step over a lot of intransigence and make a lot of changes to improve that station. The public noise off the back of my story made a lot of change, positive change happen.
I hope you feel vindicated for speaking out, Gareth.
Well, quite, yes. I do. And then I now work for Network Rail, the organisation whose former chair had me sacked. I'll let listeners draw their own conclusions from that one. Although it's a job I'm absolutely loving. I'm not in a corner painting rocks. I'm absolutely having a great time. So in a way, it's worked out well. But yeah, life throws these interesting challenges at you. And my advice, certainly what I did here, is to the best of your ability, because everyone's circumstances are different, stick with what you believe is right. Don't bend and break. Stick with what you believe. Have principles, because they get you far in life.
Gareth, I believe you helped to start a campaign group to tackle a specific issue which would be a big help to passengers.
Yeah, something I'm very passionate about, and I've only got more passionate about, if you like. I've been radicalised into this because of spending a lot more time with disabled travellers and listening to them and the challenges they have. But yeah, Tanny Gray Thompson and I sat in a pumpkin cafe in Darlington Station and discussed the challenges that people have in getting onto trains. It's all very, you know, we build lifts and that's fine, but that gets you to the platform. It doesn't get you onto the train. We have our trains built higher than our platforms, you know, about 200 millimetres higher. And it means that there is a big step up. And that's a problem because it means that disabled travellers require a ramp to get on and off trains. That's not good enough. That is not independent, equal travel. As Tanny Gray Thompson puts it, she just wants to suffer the miserable commuting experience that everyone else does. And so, yeah, Campaign for Level Boarding was founded, and we've been pushing this story about what level boarding is, this system frame solution. So it's looking at the train, the track, the platform, taking a full system approach to providing what is this radical idea of the platform and the train floor being at the same height so you can wheel on and off it easily. It's radical stuff. And we've been making very good progress, actually. Government is shifting into using this language. New train orders are, apart from a few notable exceptions, starting to incorporate level boarding. In fact, on the Island Line, the newish trains running, new slash old, depending on how you look at it, have level boarding.
Now, the UK is celebrating 200 years of the railway this year, although your book gives us a much longer historical perspective on trains and tracks. But one would imagine that we've learned all there is to know about how to do good railways, surely.
Well, you'd like to think so, but sadly, so many countries have overtaken us. You know, if you look at the top 20, as I do in the book, the top 20 railway systems in the world, we're sadly right down at the bottom of list, in the kind of the bottom few. So, you know, we're overtaken by a lot of our kind of near neighbours on the continent, but also places like Japan, even Australia, with very unbalanced either freight or passenger-only railway systems like those two countries have, they still outdo us. We've let our railway love slide to one side a bit.
That's such a shame. Have you got a favourite non-UK train network?
So this is a big challenge. So firstly, I won't spoil what the best railway system in the world is, but let's just say the Swiss and Austrian railways are particularly exceptional. But that doesn't necessarily make them my favourite, because I love an underdog. Actually, my favourite non-UK railway network is the one of the former Yugoslavia. And it's kind of a bit of a disjointed network, but the railways of Bosnia, Croatia and Slovenia, but Serbia as well, and Montenegro, are fascinating. The history of them is fascinating. The fact the network mostly appeared in the second half of the 20th century is fascinating for a country that had been kind of a meat grinder for the Nazi soldiers at that time. It's fascinating history as to how that railway appeared, built almost by volunteer parties. Really, really wonderful. But also the scenery is absolutely breathtaking. The scale is incredible.
I'd love to go and try that one out. Now, your book, How the Railways Will Fix the Future, Rediscovering the Essential Brilliance of the Iron Road, was published in 2024. Well, and you take, I would say, a fairly unique perspective on how trains have benefited society, and you do argue that without them, humanity itself won't even progress. That's a big claim, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the most existential crisis that we face currently is climate change. You know, our current politicians across the Western world seem to have forgotten it, and they seem to be talking about other things. But I'm afraid climate change has not gone away. It is getting more and more dramatic, and its impacts on us are only going to heighten. And that means enormous changes, whether we like it or not. And so I argue in the book that we have an opportunity to either decide what radical change is going to look like ourselves or have it inflicted on us. And given that transport is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, railways have to play a key part in our future. It's absolutely critical. And they are the most efficient and safest means of moving people and things across land. They are a fantastic tool, and not just about solving climate change, but solving so many other crises, whether it's loneliness, poverty of transport and our ability to move around, whether it's environmental breakdown, whether it's rising populism. The railways have a part to play in all of these.
And even though it's such a basic technology, 200 years old this very year, you're claiming it's not outdated.
No, not at all. One of the really important things, this is a thing that stuck with me because I was watching a Transport Select Committee session, and one of the MPs in the session said, well, railways have, you know, they've only been around for 200 years, and, you know, who's to say they'll be around in the future? Whereas actually the reality is that the railways have been humanity's default mass mover since we've industrialized. You know, they've been around since the times of the ancient Greeks. Railway 200 is one thing, and we're talking about the modern railway, but actually the railways, as we would recognise them today, have actually existed for hundreds and hundreds of years, been around since the late 1400s. And before that even, you know, it just happens to be that the historical records aren't great before 1495. So, you know, the technology is far from outdated, and critically, it's the fundamental physics. Steel on steel is unbelievably energy efficient. Short of us inventing transporter technology from Star Trek, we are not going to find a better, more efficient means of moving people and things across land. And given we want to be making the best use of all the resources we have, whether it's land, materials, carbon, you know, electricity and people to build the stuff, we want efficiency. And so the railways are unbeatable.
And you don't have much time for some of those slightly more radical ideas like the proposed Hyperloop and things like that.
No, Hyperloop is a thing, well, particularly given that it was a thing made up on a napkin by Elon Musk to stop Californian high-speed rail from happening. I wouldn't pay much attention to it. But, you know, things like that, what I call gadget bands, which are technologies that are desperate to pretend they're not railways when actually they are basically bound by all the same rules as railway, except they don't exist, so you can say fanciful things about them and politicians believe it. Well, they are there to distract us from the solutions that we already have. The reality is that we've solved the technology challenges with transport. We have solved them. We just need to get on and build them.
I love the way also in your book you say that movement is a basic human right, coming close to food, shelter, safety and well-being. Have you got the feeling that many politicians just don't really get that?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And it's very frustrating when you see discussions about mobility and movement that focus on cars as if cars are the thing that unlock that human right, whereas actually what cars very often do, depending on where you live in the country, they're very often limiting a lot of people's ability to move around, whether it's people in the cars stuck in traffic or whether it's people who are trying to walk around in the town and having to, you know, dodge left, right and centre because the flow of traffic is the thing that is prioritised. You know, everyone hates those when you have to cross the road and you get stuck in one of those little gates pens halfway across the road. That's because we prioritise the movement of metal boxes over the movement of people. And it goes bigger than that, of course, in all the different ways that focusing on mobility around kind of motor traffic and, you know, road transport has actually impacted substantially on the way our society looks, the way our society has developed, you know, the level of consumerism, that level of caring of our neighbours that has been diminished by the fact that we've put strips of tarmac between everyone. It's a fundamental way that our culture has emerged in the second half of the 20th century that has caused a lot of the problems we have today.
I hope you don't mind me saying, from as you've spoken today, but also particularly from your book, you get really passionate, almost a bit sort of frustrated with the powers that be and the world order, about just sort of how complacent they've been about not addressing the crucial needs of delivering improved railways. I think at one point you say railways are the past and the future of human mobility. I just don't understand why decision makers are not hearing this.
Yeah, I think the challenge comes from imagination and vision. I'm afraid to say that politicians at the moment there are plenty of exceptions to this, but the mainstream politicians we have at the moment do not have that long-term vision. They don't have the imagination to imagine what the future might look like. They're very much focused on the here and now. How do we improve our polling? Focusing on the, well, not much more than a year or two ahead. Whether you like it, whether you think about our species or even whether you think about taxpayers' money, which is a thing that gets thrown around a lot. Well, I'll be paying tax probably for about 80 years of my life, i.e. all of it, because even when the moment you're born, you're paying tax through VAT. And so if we thought about taxpayers' money on a longer term, like 80 years rather than one or two, maybe we'd be spending that money better. And therefore, maybe we'd be thinking more strategically about movement and therefore then going, oh, well, actually, railways are the right thing to do here rather than, oh, what's the status quo? How can I stick to that?
Crikey, this is radical stuff. Railways have perhaps not always been a force for good, though. I mean, you explain how their establishment aided the slave trade and even colonial powers, don't you?
Yeah, so this is one of the strange things about railways, is that, and this is why it's important to understand railways didn't just kick off in the early part of the 1800s, they existed before, because what changed that moved us into the modern railway era was all of a sudden there was the demise of an industry, and that industry was the transatlantic slave trade. We just had abolishment, we had a huge amount of capital put into people's pockets by the reimbursement, the kind of the compensation paid not to the slaves but to their owners by, you know, the UK government, money that we have been in debt repaying until I think only a few years ago. So this meant that there was suddenly not just a load of extra capital sloshing around, but we had all of the infrastructure, all of the people like clerks, managers, you know, all the merchants, all of the wholesalers, all the warehousing, all of the infrastructure that had been set up for the transatlantic slave trade. And all of that was needed somewhere to go. And it's all of a sudden you have this technology that was starting to build up a bit of traction up in the Northeast and in a few places with George Stephenson's various kind of rollings out of wagonways. They were everywhere across the country at this point. Stephenson was seen as the preeminent engineer, and so his technology was chosen for the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, which is a railway built primarily for slave-won cotton from the Americas to be taken up to the mills in Manchester and the surrounding area. So we can see that, and lots of the railways across the country, the directors of those railways were those who had been involved very heavily in the transatlantic slave trade. So in a way, one industry collapsed, transatlantic slave trade, and another rose up. So whereas previously railways had been quite localized, quite disparate, suddenly they became an enormous industry, you know, this enormous mighty movement of capital, and were deployed for some pretty dubious reasons. So you know, you look to countries like India or countries on the coasts of Africa and even Wales, where the railways were not built necessarily to connect up population centers and be particularly useful. You can see that they're kind of these fractal patterns. They look a bit like kind of rivers kind of darting out from the coast, because they were built to extract mineral wealth from colonies, from colonial countries where empires like the British Empire, not just the British Empire, were extracting wealth for their own benefit. So yeah, the railways many times not used for good.
Yeah, and you've got the classic ones of trying to get across Africa, or the one to Baghdad from the Germans were trying to build. There's quite a lot of examples of where railways were perhaps used for slightly more dubious reasons.
Yeah, and that's before we even think about what they were being used for in the, you know, potentially giving us the First World War, and, you know, by the fact that they created logistics that couldn't be turned around. And then in the Second World War, you know, we know what the railways were used for on the continent when we look to places like Auschwitz. So, yeah, a pretty dark history.
But the subtitle of your book is Rediscovering the Brilliance of the Iron Road. So what's your agenda? How do you suggest we do that?
Well, it comes back to this energy efficiency. You know, the railways were good because of the fact that the interface between steel wheel and steel rail is unbelievably energy efficient. You know, that size of your thumbnail, that patch means that friction is extremely low. And so you can move the equivalent of, you know, 80, 100 lorries behind one locomotive. You know, nothing can beat that. Nothing can beat that. And we can harness that for good. If we understand that history and we accept and understand the current relationship that railways have with native populations, indigenous populations, and indeed the UK, and how, you know, we've seen how there were challenges in the way that HS2 was communicated to communities along its route. If we understand all that and do better, understand and do better, and this is me calling to my fellow engineers, we are not just consultants doing our little job. We have a big impact on society and we need to tell that story. But we can harness those physics, those fundamental laws of physics, to do with the railways what we in places are already doing. You know, across the world, we see how railways are a fantastic way to move around, whether it's high-speed rail, whether it's suburban rail and urban rail, metro systems. They are brilliant. Whether it's moving freight up and down in Norway, you know, enough mass going down the hill that it generates more electricity than is needed to take the train up the hill. It's basically a perpetual motion machine. It's, you know, this is incredible sort of stuff that we see across the world. Railways can be brilliant.
And is there anything that we as the passengers can do to help spread the good word of railways?
I think don't be afraid to moan when things are not working, because you'll be amazed how much that results in change happening. Twitter is still sort of quite good for that, but, you know, don't be afraid to use other platforms to kind of communicate your challenge. But speak to your MP. Always tell your MP what's important to you. It doesn't have to be you saying something grumpy. Tell your MP something that you think is really great and that you care a lot about and that you think is really important for the next time that everyone will be going to the polls. That makes a remarkable amount of difference. Do not underestimate how much difference it makes to tell your MP what you think about and what you care about and what might make them get in again if you have a chance to vote for them.
Well, you've certainly done a pretty amazing job championing the railways, Gareth. Tell us about your own podcast YouTube channel, Rail Natter. I understand you've just reached a bit of a landmark number of episodes.
Yeah, we blasted through 250 episodes a while back, actually. I'm approaching 260. I mean, 5 years plus going now. We have covered everything. I mean, I love it. I absolutely adore it. You know, the messages I get from people saying, you've inspired me to join the industry, or you've inspired me to get into campaigning, those absolutely keep me going. But it's a lot of fun. We do all sorts. It's chaos. There is going to be, actually, I'm moving into a regime where the audio-only version of the podcast is going to be a bit tighter. But if you like the anarchy and chaos of what is often a live episode where you can actually ask me questions while I'm doing the episode, then Rail Natter is for you, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. And we cover all sorts, left, right, and centre. You name it, we cover it. Within transport, whether it's art, whether it's engineering, whether it's nuts and bolts, whether it's big strategy pieces, we've got it all covered.
And each episode is sometimes well over an hour long. How on earth do you achieve all this and hold down a job and have a family at the same time? You can't ever sleep, sir.
Actually, the reason it's long is because it means I don't have to do the edit. Those edited episodes, which I do love doing, and there are a few scattered around that you can enjoy, those tightly edited episodes where I'm out and about doing something somewhere take me more time than it takes for me to do the 1 hour, 1.5 hour episodes in the evening. So kind of that's the way I do it, actually, is that I do the hour and a half episode without necessarily doing the heavy edit, which allows me to do it. But you know, these are subjects that I love. Often I'm speaking to people when I've got guests on that are just fascinating, interesting, you know, informed people. There's a community that loves it and that's really kind of really, they get involved. It's just a really, really nice space. And there's, yeah, we cover all sorts and we keep, you know, new people keep coming along and being excited and interested as well. And we're topical, which is really important.
Well, I'm sure there can't be many people who don't know your work, but could you maybe point out a few episodes that people should come and look for, especially about fixing the railways?
Well, we've had episode 48, we covered the tunnels under the US Capitol with Anne Gavin, which is fascinating. Episode 57 was, we covered what the Welsh railway map should look like and why we need a new north-south main line. We have done, you know, episode 7, we had Tim Dunn, and Tim's been back a few times, which is great fun. Episode 222 was about what the ideal high-speed rail network for Britain and indeed the UK and indeed Ireland as well, actually, the whole lot would look like. You know, we had episode 6 was a real delight. One of the kind of cornerstone episodes where we looked at what might have happened had the advanced passenger train had it succeeded. You know, what needed to happen for it to succeed, and what might that have changed about British railway history. So yeah, and then the most recent, we did a series very recently on a metro system for Glasgow. So there's all sorts of things that we cover. You know, a huge range of different bits and bobs. Go in, pick a randomly scroll around the page, find a subject that looks interesting, and dive in. There's no need to just watch all of them or watch the latest one. There'll be a subject in there for you.
And I believe you even did a rail natter about the Island Line too.
I did, yeah. Back episode 32, we went the Island of Tube Trains. It's a really fun episode, actually. There's all sorts of pictures in there. There's pictures of polystyrene sellotape to the top of tube trains, pictures of flooded tunnels, you name it. We covered it. It was a really nice episode, that one, actually. Lovely.
Gareth, I could talk forever with you, but so now you know it is possible to get a better railway in Britain, and Gareth Dennis is the man to follow on social media, or his podcast Rail Natter, and of course his excellent book How the Railways Will Fix the Future is available online or in bookshops. Thanks for joining us, Gareth.
An absolute delight. Thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed listening and learning as much as I have from Gareth. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're hearing about collecting transport timetables and their beautiful cover artworks.